My name is David Mateos. And I'll be here all week at the other building in office 463. So if anybody has any questions at any time, you can come and try to find me, and I'll try to answer them. Or ask me during the lectures. You can interrupt me anytime. So I'll be talking about an application, a specific application of ADS-CFT, which consists of trying to use this duality to learn about quantum chromodynamics, the theory of the strong interactions of quarks and gluons. And so the plan of the lectures is, first of all, to ask and try to answer why, in principle, you should expect QCD answering theory to be related. Secondly, we will discuss an example of an equivalence or a duality between a specific gauge theory and a specific string theory. So this will be a duality between strings in ADS and a conformal field theory, which is not the case for QCD, but it's a simple example. These two lectures may have overlap with things that you have already heard. And if somebody is bored, please let me know, and then I'll try to skip it or speed it up. But some of these things are sufficiently important that I think it won't hurt if you hear them for a second time or from a different perspective. And in addition, then at least I'll know that we are all on the same page, OK? And some of the things that I'll say are very important to understand the rest of the lectures. So in the third lecture, what I'll do is to use this simplest example of a duality to actually already, with very little technology, make contact with experiment. So what we'll do is to consider the theory that we're studying here, the gauge theory at finite temperature, and see how we can compute observables that are relevant for physics of heavy ion collisions. RIC here stands for relativistic heavy ion collider, where the object of study is the deconfined phase of QCD, namely the so-called quark gluon plasma. Okay? I'll tell you exactly what that means. Then in the fourth lecture, we'll actually try to construct, and we'll construct, the first example, and possibly the simplest, of a confining of the string theory dual to a confining gauge theory. Okay? The example that you have seen here, n equals 4 super young Mills, is not a confining theory, whereas quantum chromodynamics is. So we would like to have examples where we can describe confinement and other phenomena that appear in QCD. But of course, in QCD, if you start heating up the system, having higher and higher temperatures, like in the early universe, eventually you break up the hadrons, the quarks and the gluons become deconfined, and there is a thermal phase transition into the quark gluon plasma phase. So here we'll see how to construct the confining and the non-confining solutions, and how there is a phase transition in the gravity description that corresponds to the confinement-deconfinement transition in the gauge theory. Okay. And then, so everything that I'm going to say up to here has to do with gauge theories that have degrees of freedom only in the adjoint representation. They have gauge bosons and matter, like scalar fields and fermions, but they all transform in the adjoint of the gauge group. Does everybody know what this means? OK, if you don't know, I'll make it clear. OK? However, in QCD, can somebody tell me what the degrees of freedom in QCD are? I'll tell you now in a second, but the gluons and the quarks. OK, in what representation of SU3 color do the quarks transform? In the fundamental. OK, gluons have two indices, quarks have one index. OK? So that's a very important fact about QCD, which is not present in any of the theories that we will describe up to here. So in addition to wanting to construct theories that are confining, we also want theories that have degrees of freedom in the fundamental representation, because those will resemble, their dynamics resembles much more the dynamics of the quarks than the matter in these other gauge theories. Is that clear? So as you can see, the goal is to go from the simplest but more removed away from QCD down to more complicated but closer to QCD. Any questions so far? OK, there may be a few more points here, depending on how we do with time, but we will see. Now, another thing. The purpose of this course is to take you as far as possible in terms of ideas and the developments in the field with as little technology as possible. Okay, so the emphasis is on the ideas and the concepts, not on technical details. Okay. So for that reason, I will actually assume very little about what you know. Very little. Just familiarity with a few concepts that you probably are familiar with. But if there are things that I say that you don't know, raise your hand and stop me. Because if you get lost in the beginning, then there's no, that defeats the purpose. Any questions? No? Okay. Yes. About the what? Oh, the representations. Okay. So, if by the end of this lecture that's not clear, ask me again. Okay? Very good. So, I think I have no more to say about the plan. So, if there are no questions, then I'll start with the first one. So, Jaume Gomis already told you a lot about the large and sea limit. Okay? And that's going to be the main purpose, explaining that of this lecture. But before I get into that, let me give you a couple of heuristic arguments for why QCD, why you might expect QCD to start with to be related with a string theory. Okay? The first reason is that QCD, in fact, does contain string-like objects. Because as you know, so the first reason is flux theorems. As you know, QCD is a confining theory, which means that at low energies, quarks and antiquarks are always bound together into color singlets by a force that grows linearly with the distance, and which is due to something called flux theorems, which are, if you like, the color analogs of the electric lines. And the difference with electromagnetism is that in electromagnetism they spread. In QCD, they actually confined and localized over a tube-like object that resembles a string. Okay, so if you try to pull the quarks apart, the string grows. And that's the reason why the energy of a quark-antiquark pair grows linearly with the distance. Okay, and therefore you would need an infinite energy to separate them and to break them apart. Yes?
So what does this really mean? Does it mean that there are no field lines anywhere else?
No, there may be, but the energy is mostly localized in this region and falls off exponentially away from the region. Whereas, as you know, in electromagnetism, it falls off as a power law. Okay, that's the first reason. And the second one, which is also very phenomenological, is that QCD exhibits something called redshift behavior. Oh, by the way, one thing I forgot to say, which is very important. Please don't take notes. Because everything I'm going to say down to the fourth lecture is in a review that's available online, and I'll give you the reference. Okay? So I'd rather have you, everything I'm going to say is there. I'd rather have you listen to me and then go to the review, which is, where you will actually be able to find everything I'm going to say written nicely, as opposed to the way I'm saying it on the spot. Okay? So the reference for that. It's 07091523 kph, and it's called string theory and quantum chromodynamics. Very good. So I was saying the second reason is redshift behavior. What this means is that if you look at the mass squared of, say, mesons as a function of the angular momentum of the meson, you find that this is some constant times j. Okay, so the mass squared is linear in j. If you plot it, you find that mesons lie on straight lines. And this fact is immediately explained if you make a very simple model for a meson consisting of an open string that's rotating with angular momentum j. if you model your meson, if you imagine that your meson has a quark and an antiquark at the endpoints, and they are connected by a string, and that most of the energy is in the string, so you neglect the masses of the quarks, and you assume that it's rotating with angular momentum j, you will find, you can compute the energy, and you will find that the energy squared is linear in j. Okay? So these two are kind of phenomenological, if you like, suggestive pieces of evidence that might lead you to believe that string theory has something to do with QCD. But they are very heuristic. Okay? The most rigorous, in my opinion, argument for why QCD and any gauge theory, in fact, is related to a string theory is the large NC limit. And that's what I'm going to explain now. And another thing is, note that these two arguments apply to confining theories. Okay? If the theory is not confining, there are no flux tubes. Quark antiquarks, quarks and antiquarks are not necessarily bound together. And there may or may not be mesons, namely normalizable bound states. Okay? Whereas what I'm going to say now about the large NC limit applies to any gauge theory, confining or non-confining. And we will see lots of examples of non-confining theories that have a string description. Okay? Very good. So, okay, so hopefully you all know that QCD is an SU3 color. This is the color gauge group, gauge theory. Yes? Any notes? No? Okay, very good. And a very important thing about QCD that Jama also discussed is that you may think that QCD has a coupling constant, G Young-Mills, which, if small, you might be able to expand in and therefore construct a systematic approximation to the exact result in your theory and be able to calculate at least when G Young-Mills is small. However, you also know that this is actually not true because one of the most fundamental facts about QCD is dimensional transmutation, which means that, in fact, this depends on the energy scale. It's not a constant. It depends on the energy at which you're probing, say, doing some scattering. And in fact, what is a constant is something called lambda QCD, which is a dimension full parameter. So because this depends on the energy, in principle, the only parameter that you had in the theory that you could expand in, because you don't know how to solve the theory exactly, in fact, there's always a region where G Young-Mills becomes strong, or the one or larger. So there is always a region which is at low energies in QCD at low energies around lambda QCD. This becomes of order 1. So at very high energies you can do a perturbative expansion, but if you want to understand confinement, chiral symmetry breaking, etc., which are phenomena at low energies, then you need to solve strongly coupled physics. Okay? So QCD has no obvious expansion parameter, because the only obvious one is not really a parameter. It's a function. Okay? So you have to look for a not so obvious expansion parameter. And this was Tuft's idea. So what is the... So Tuft's idea was to replace the gauge group SU3 by SUNC, where n is a parameter, and then expand in 1 over n. So you might have thought naively that if you replace SU3 by SUN with n very large, the theory becomes more complicated. But actually, the opposite is true, as we are going to see. The theory actually simplifies dramatically, even though we still don't know how to solve it in that limit, but it simplifies very much. So let me remind you of something I was saying before about the degrees of freedom in QCD. QCD has gluons, the gauge bosons that carry the color, the interactions, and quarks and antiquarks. Okay, so the gluons are usually represented, they are vectors okay, vector bosons with two color indices. So mu is a Lorentz index, and I and j are color. So I and j go from 1 to nc. And it also has quarks and antiquarks, which are usually denoted by qi, a, so these are spinners, okay, Dirac fermions. And a here is the flavor index, because we can have more than one type of quark, for example, the u, d, s, okay, top, bottom, etc. So a goes from 1 to nf. Nf is going to denote the number of flavors, number of different quark species. And I, as before, goes from 1 to nc. So you see that the number of gluons, the number of degrees of freedom of gluons, this grows like nc squared. OK? Because essentially, because you have two indices going from 1 to nc. There's a subtlety here, because the gauge group is sunc and not unc. So sunc has actually nc squared minus 1 degrees of freedom, because these are traceless matrices. But we're not going to worry about that, because in the large nc limit, nc squared and nc squared minus 1 are the same for us. Okay? Whereas these guys have nf nc degrees of freedom. So if you take nc, the gauge group, to be larger and larger, and you keep the number of flavors fixed, nf fixed, then you see that this grows, just a second, grows faster than that. And the first consequence that you might imagine, which is true, is that the dynamics in this limit is dominated by the gluons. And quarks will give you subleading corrections to these dynamics. Yes? What? NF? Oh, sorry, this is NF, not NL. NF. F stands for flavor. So as you know, the quarks have a global group index, which is the flavor that just tells you if it's a U quark, a D quark, an S quark, B quark, etc. In what? No, in pure Young-Mills there are no quarks. So pure Young-Mills would be this Lagrangian squared, where the trace is over I and J. Okay. If you add quarks, then here you have a sum over flavors. Okay, because each quark has, I called it A, QA, I, D slash Q. Okay, so this would sum over U quark, D quark, etc. No, the quarks are in the fundamental representation of the gauge group, meaning, just a second, meaning the following thing. This SUNC is a gauge group that acts on the fields in your theory. So under a gauge transformation, an object in the fundamental representation, like the quark, goes to U times Q, where U is an SUNC matrix. Okay, so if you put the indices here, this would be something like this. So it transforms as a column. Okay? If you have something in the adjoint, like A is a connection, it's not really, strictly speaking, in the adjoint. But if you have a field in the adjoint representation, then say something like this, ij, okay, this will go into u pi u minus 1. So a field in the adjoint transforms on both sides, because it has two indices. If you put the indices here, ij, this is I, k, k, l, l, j. So this is in the adjoint, this is in the fundamental. And fields in the adjoint representation have nc squared degrees of freedom, because they have three indices. Is this clear?
Yeah. And how about when we write the gluons, like a mu with an index a, one for each
generator?
Yeah.
That's the same thing, because what that's doing is saying, if you forget about the mu index, okay, for a second, this is a matrix, ij, in the Lie algebra of SUN. So I can expand any matrix in that Lie algebra in a basis of matrices for that Lie algebra. So I can say that A, let me suppress the new index, ij is equal to a sum over generators, let's call them alpha, of A alpha T alpha ij. Is this clear? So it's completely equivalent. And I'm just going to write it like this because this makes it manifest how many degrees of freedom there are in these matrices.
And the number of generators equal to the number of colors?
The number of generators is the dimension of the group. Okay? So for example, for SU3, how many generators does SU3 have? 8, which is not equal to 3, okay? Because NC just tells you that the matrix is NC by NC minus 1 because it's traceless, okay? So NC is the rank of the gauge group, roughly speaking, whereas the number of generators is the dimension of the group. Yeah?
In this notation, AIJ is the component of the matrix or the whole matrix?
This? This is the ij component of the matrix T alpha.
So this is just an expansion of the ij component of A.
Exactly. This is a matrix. If I suppress the matrix indices, this is the expansion of a matrix in coefficients times the basis of the matrix space.
When you count the number of degrees of freedom of the quarks, should you also count the spinner indices that you have?
Yes, yes. But just like here, all I'm counting is how things scale with NC.
Oh, yeah, the fixed number.
But I'm not, of course, these guys have an extra spinorial index that I'm not writing down explicitly. And this one also I didn't count because it's a vector. So each gluon has two polarizations. So there's a two somewhere here. But all I'm interested in is how things scale with large NC because that's. That counting is crucial for understanding why the dynamics simplifies in that area. Any other questions? Okay. Good. So let's examine in a little bit of detail how a particularly simple diagram scales when I take NC to be large. So consider the one loop gluon correction. To the gluon propagator. Okay? So there's a gluon with indices ij coming in, another gluon, the same one, with the same indices because of conservation of color. And where I'm computing is the one loop correction by virtual gluons running in the loop to this gluon propagator. Is this clear? Yes? OK. So how does this diagram scale with NC and the Young-Mills coupling constant? Well, I have two vertices here and here, okay, two three-point vertices. Each of them gives me a power of the coupling constant, which is G Young-Mills squared, because I have two of them. But if you look at the color indices running in the loop, you see that an ij gluon can give you here ik, and here you can have jk. Okay, and this index k you have to sum over, because it's like summing over the momentum running in the loop. Okay, that momentum is not determined by the incoming momentum alone. So the color of the gluon is also not completely determined, because this gluon can split into a gluon with color ik and another one with color kj, and the two of them recombine to give you ij. So color is conserved. But because we sum over k, and k goes from 1 to nc, we get a factor of nc here. Is this clear? OK. So you see, this already tells you immediately that if you want to consider NC larger and larger, in particular, if you want to take this limit and still end up with a theory that gives you finite corrections to the tree-level free calculation, when you scale nc to infinity, at the same time, you have to send g squared to 0, keeping this combination fixed, so that in that limit, the one loop correction stays finite. Okay? If it goes to 0, then the theory will become trivial, because the same will happen to all amplitudes. And if it diverges, then Feynman diagrams don't mean anything. Okay? So the conclusion is that we have to send nc to infinity, or take it to be very large. But at the same time, g squared Young-Mills is going to go to 0. And we are going to keep this combination, g squared Young-Mills nc, fixed. This quantity here is called the toothed coupling. Okay? Very good. Now, here we argued what the NC scaling of this diagram is by explicitly looking at the color indices running the loop, etc. But if you get a very complicated diagram, it's not easy to actually follow all the color and deduce in a simple way what the large NC scaling is, which is very important. This is very, very much simplified if you use something called double line notation, which I think Jaume Gomis already introduced. But let me review it in the specific case of QCD. Okay? So it's actually really simple. It's just based on the observation that as far as color is concerned, and only as far as color is concerned, you can represent a quark by a single line. So this will be a quark. This will be an antiquark, say J bar. And then a gluon, for the purpose of keeping track of color, is like a quark antiquark. Why? Because a quark has one index, an antiquark has another one, and a gluon has two indices. So you can just represent Aij in this way. I should be, to be precise, I should be putting j bars, or bars over some of the indices, but I'm not going to do that because then we'll stay here until tomorrow. Okay? And at some point, I'll stop drawing the arrows. But that will happen a little later. For the moment, I'll draw them. Okay? So this would be a gluon. So let's draw this diagram in this notation. Well, before we do that, let's draw the vertices in this notation. So for example, the three gluon vertex in this notation is simply this. OK, if this is ik, kl, lj, j, I, okay, then here this would be something like this. With the same indices, I, in fact, k bar, k, l bar. Sorry, this should be, I lost track here. Sorry, let me do it again. Ij, jk, ki. Okay, so this should be k, sorry, j bar, k, ki bar. And I didn't put the bars correctly here, but you can do it. Now, the vertex between a quark antiquark and a gluon is simply this. OK? Quark, antiquark, and gluon with two lines. And then we can now draw this diagram in this notation. So we have a gluon coming in, a gluon in the loop. So this is going to look like this. And a gluon coming out. And if you put the arrows, it will be something like this. And this will be going this way and this way. OK? And the indices are the same as up here. And now you see immediately why we get a factor of nc. Because all you have to do is look at the closed lines that are not contracted with any other line except itself. Okay? each of these closed lines is a color line that you're summing over, whose color is completely undetermined. So this line is the reason here where you get a factor of nc. Now, let's draw a few more diagrams, because this will teach us how different diagrams scale in the large nc limit. And we'll see that a classification emerges. Okay? So what I'm going to do is to, first of all, work in a theory only with gluons. Why? Because I told you at the beginning that quarks, because there are only nc of them as opposed to nc squared, will give corrections. So let's deal first with the dominant dynamics, which are the gluons. And secondly, I'm going to focus on vacuum diagrams. Okay, so diagrams in which there are no external legs, multi-loop diagrams of this type. Why? Because adding the external legs will essentially add no further complication. Once you understand the vacuum diagrams, adding the legs doesn't change the physics. Okay. So let's draw first, in fact, that same diagram we just said. So all these vacuum diagrams that I'm going to draw, you can think of them as contributions to the vacuum energy in the theory, because there are no external legs. These are just vacuum energies. Okay? Are there any questions so far? Yes.
So we are talking things of making sure that the vacuum, how can we subtract the vacuum diagram? So ones in the traditional quantum field, of course. And here we are dealing with the vacuum diagrams.
Yes.
So I guess there's a lot of information in the vacuum diagram that is usually not taught.
Yes, for example, they are important when you're doing finite temperature physics, as we will, because then the physics depends on the temperature. And also, if you like, you can just think of them as diagrams with external legs that you amputated.
Oh, right.
Because the points I want to illustrate are completely contained in the vacuum diagram, but you can imagine that you're attaching external legs if you like. So let's look first at this one loop diagram that we had over there. Let me just repeat it. But now we have no external legs. Okay, so this in double line notation is this. Now, can somebody tell me how this diagram scales in the large nc limit?
nc squared.
Why? Because there are two closed lines that are not contracted with anybody else. Okay. And it's a vacuum diagram without vertices. Okay, so there are no factors of G and U. Now let's look at the two loop diagram. Say, for example, this one. Okay, in double line notation, we have the external loop as before, but now here we have two vertices and a gluon in the middle. And you can convince yourselves that it corresponds to this diagram. Okay? All I'm doing is replacing every gluon line here by a double line and joining them according to the vertices. Okay? This is something you have to be careful about. So now I need a volunteer to tell me how this scales. Let's see. Let's start with the factors of G Yang Mills. Who votes for one? Okay, two. Very good. That's it. Okay. G Yang Mills squared. And how many powers of NC?
Three.
Two?
Three.
Three?
Three?
Okay, very good. Okay, because I have the external loop, one, and then two internal loops, that give me three. So this now, I'm going to rewrite in terms of the tooth coupling, because remember, in the large nc limit, that's the quantity that stays fine. Tooth coupling and nc. So this g squared with one n gives me lambda. So this is lambda nc squared. So this, as far as the nc counting goes, scales the same way. But it has an extra power of lambda. And you'll see this is because this is a one loop diagram, this is a two loop diagram. So higher loops increase the power of lambda. Okay? To see this, let's draw a three loop diagram. And don't worry, this is the last one that I draw without any extra ingredients. Okay? So let's draw this diagram. Okay. Now in double line notation, I have, as before, the external loop, and now I have three gluons inside, so three sets of double lines. And they're all connected. You can convince yourselves in this way. Yeah, very inspiring, huh? Okay. So, again, how many powers of G Young Mills? Three? Anybody for three? Four? Five, anybody? Okay. So four. Okay? One, two, three, four vertices. Is this clear? This counting is very important. So make sure you understand it. How many powers of NC? Let's count. One external loop, and then one, two, and three internal loops. So four. So in terms of lambda, now we have g to the fourth. OK, remember lambda is g squared nc. So if I pull out two powers of nc and combine with this, this is lambda squared nc squared. OK? So you see the pattern? All diagrams of this type scale as nc squared. And they differ in the number of vertices. And that gives rise to higher and higher powers of lambda. So what you see is that for diagrams of this type, lambda is the loop counting parameter, okay? The expansion parameter in the loop expansion. And they all scale like nc squared. So these diagrams, as we are going to see, are the dominant ones in the large nc limit. Can somebody tell me the physical interpretation for why these diagrams scale as nc squared? And not something else? Let's see. How many degrees of freedom? OK, what are we confusing? The vacuum energy of the theory. Vacuum energy, OK? The vacuum energy receives contributions from every degree of freedom. And all gluons are indistinguishable one from each other, so they all contribute the same. So if I have nc squared of them, the vacuum energy has to scale like nc squared. Yes? I'm not just emphasizing this for the purpose of emphasizing it, but you'll see that this is reproduced in the gravity description. Okay, the vacuum, the free energy or the vacuum energy of the theory in the string description will also scale like nc squared. Now, not all diagrams scale as nc squared. There are some diagrams that scale with a smaller power. So, for example, consider this three loop diagram. Where the crucial thing to note is that these two lines cross but don't intersect. There is no vertex here. That's very important. Okay? Because now, in double line notation, this has, as before, the external line. Now I have to draw this one. Okay? Which, of course, goes up again this way. And there's another glue in the middle, but they don't intersect. So now, when I continue these lines, I get this thing here. Is it clear? If you look at that review, the picture is better than the one I'm drawing. But I hope the message is clear. So now, let's bet again. How many powers of G Young Mills?
Four.
OK, four vertices of the four. How many powers of n?
Two.
Two? Three?
Two.
Two. Very good. Because now we have the external loop, but the internal one is one single loop that all closes upon itself. OK, if you start here and you follow it, you go up, down, up, here, underneath, up again, down, here, and up.
It's a single line, okay? So this goes nc squared, which is lambda squared. So you see, this three-loop diagram compared to this other three-loop diagram scales as lambda squared, but is suppressed with respect to this one by a power of 1 over nc squared. Okay? And you'll see that what's crucial is that this diagram is called non-planar. These ones are called planar because you can draw them on a plane without crossing lines that don't intersect. If they cross, they have to intersect. They have vertices. Whereas this one cannot be drawn on a plane without crossing lines. Okay? I'm going to make this a little more precise now, but this is the idea. So just a second. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to ask about G. You said G
gets large at low energies, right?
Yes.
So how can we...
Excellent question. What do I mean by sending G to 0?
Yeah.
Okay. The answer to this is that what I mean is that you take a scale, E, or mu, okay, the renormalization group scale, or the subtraction point, mu. You look at G squared Jan Mills at that scale, at a given scale, whatever, but a reference scale. And then this times nc is lambda at that scale, and this stays fixed. Okay? So one of the exercises that I'll ask you to do with the tutors is to show that this scaling here, fixing this, scaling nc to infinity and g Jan Mills to 0, keeping this combination fixed, is equivalent to taking the large n limit, keeping lambda QCD fixed. Okay, the confinement scale fixed. But that has to do with the beta function of the theory, and that's one of the, it's a very simple exercise. But that's a very good question. Yes?
The confinement diagram is the same as that, which can be drawn.
This one? No, you'll see why it's not. Bear with me. You'll see why. Okay, but before I make it precise, let me give one more example of a diagram that's even more suppressed than this one, just so that you see that there's really a classification and that a diagram can scale with any power of n. Okay? So consider this five-loop diagram. Okay? Now, well, you get the idea. Let me know, well, okay. This looks like this. And then all these things are joined here. Okay? Oh, sorry, I missed this one. Okay. So, powers of G Jan Mills. Very good. 8 vertices. Okay? Powers of N? 2. Because again, if you start following the line, there's only one in interior line plus the external one, nc squared. So this is lambda to the fourth over nc squared. So you see, this one was suppressed with respect to the leading diagrams by 1 over nc squared. This one is suppressed by 1 over nc to the fourth, and so on and so forth. You can keep drawing diagrams that are more and more suppressed. Okay. So the first conclusion that we draw from this, and we will make it more precise, is that diagrams are classified by their topology. Okay? And non-planar diagrams are 1 over nc squared suppressed. By which I mean
by powers of 1 over n c squared, okay? It can be 1, 2, etc., or higher powers. So let's make this idea. This idea is the key to why a gauge theory has a connection with the string description, okay? And to make it more precise, I have to tell you how I'm going to associate to each Feynman diagram a Riemann surface. And then you'll see that the expansion in Feynman diagrams in the gauge theory corresponds to an expansion in Riemann surfaces in some other yet to be found string theory, okay? So how do we do this? It's actually really simple. What we'll do to construct the Riemann surface is to each, so in double line notation, to each loop, you notice each loop can be thought of as the boundary of a piece of a surface, okay? For example, this one here. Okay, this internal loop is the boundary of this disk. And then also to the external loops, in order to get a compact Riemann surface, you'll see why in a second, we will also associate, we will think of that as the boundary of the rest of the plane. Okay? And then we'll take these pieces, plus the point at infinity for the plane, and we will glue them together by specific rules, which are that we glue them together along, according to how the boundaries, the loops, are drawn in the diagram. I'll give you an example in a second, you'll see exactly what I mean. But this is a completely unambiguous procedure. For a given Feynman diagram, it always gives you a compact, closed compact Riemann surface in this case. Okay, so let's draw a few examples and see how this works. And then hopefully it'll be completely clear. Okay, so let's take this one. These two are too simple. Let's take this one. Okay? So, do we have color, chalk? Okay, so in the meantime, in order to keep track of the different pieces that we are going to glue together, let's number them. So this one is going to be 1, 2, 3, and the one on the outside that I told you is the entire plane compactified with a point at infinity, 4. Okay, so that's the first one, second one, third one, and this one. So I have to take this. Imagine you actually make a rubber piece resembling each of these, and you glue them together along the boundaries according to how the boundaries are joined together in the diagram. Okay? So what you get for this one is the following thing. The one on the outside is going to be this one. Okay? So if I take the outside and I add the point at infinity, I get, thank you, the lower hemisphere of a sphere. Now, 1, 2, and 3 are going to be, let's see, this looks like this. And this goes over like that. And like this. OK, so this is 1, 3, and 2. Does anybody not see this? So these three pieces, if you look at them from above, they are exactly these three. Joined together along the boundaries, these three boundaries are this, this, and the one behind. OK? And they are all joined over this boundary with the external face. So in this case, the corresponding Riemann surface is a two-sphere. I should make this a little more like this. Is this clear? Does anybody not see this? Okay, so a sphere is a Riemann surface with genus 0. What this means, as you know, Riemann surfaces are closed, orientable, and compact. Riemann surfaces are classified by their genus, meaning that this classification gives you the sphere, the torus with two holes, etc. Okay, and the genus is 0 for the sphere, 1 for this one, 2 for this one, etc. Yes? Okay. Now, to each Riemann surface, there is something. There's a topological number associated to it called the Euler number, okay, chi, which is given by 2 minus 2g. And it turns out that, I'm going to give you a few more examples now, but it turns out that the power of n in the large n expansion of a given Feynman diagram turns out to be nc to the chi, where chi is the Euler number of the associated Riemann surface. Let me say it again. You take any Feynman diagram, no matter how complicated. That Feynman diagram has some specific scaling with nc, once you express it in terms of lambda and nc, in the large n limit. Okay? The claim is that that power is exactly the Euler number of the Riemann surface that you associate to that diagram. In other words, if you know the topology of the Riemann surface associated to a given diagram, you know how that diagram scales in the large nc limit. Let's draw another example, which is very interesting because it's going to give us this guy. Okay? So we need, you see, for the sphere, chi is 2 minus 2g is 2. Okay? So nc to the chi is nc squared, which is exactly what we got. Now let's draw one that's suppressed, the one that's scaled only like lambda. Okay? So let's consider the diagram we had before here, this one. This, remember, was this thing. Okay? Let's draw the Riemann surface. It's not so easy now. It's not very complicated, but so now we have the external face that we'll call 2. And the internal face. Now there is only one internal face, because remember, each face has a boundary that's one closed loop. But on the inner, on the interior now, we only have one loop. So there's only one internal face that we'll call 1. Okay? So now, if you try to draw the Riemann surface that you get, let me draw it for you and you'll see it, and then in the exercises, I will ask you to draw one that has not this Riemann surface, but this one. It's more fun. So, but once you understand this one, it's not very complicated. So let's see. Let me first draw the Riemann surface. And now we have 2 here. And we have the following. You see where I'm going, right? minus 1 here. You know, when you draw it while you're sitting down, it's not so difficult. But on the blackboard, your IQ drops. So this one comes back. Over here. Okay. Very good. So this is 1. I seriously, and also this bit here, I seriously invite you to sit down and think about this and try to visualize it. Okay? This is what you get. And this is the answer to your question. This diagram is not topologically the same as that one. Okay? Because certainly this is not the same as the sphere topologically. Okay? So this diagram has chi equals 2 minus 2g, which is 2 minus 2 because g is 1 for the torus, which is 0. So this should scale as nc to the chi equals nc to the 0. So no powers of nc. And remember, this diagram scaled like what? Like lambda or? Just the power of lambda, lambda squared. OK? Yes? Aha, it is too much trouble. No, it's. Let me not do it on the spot, because in fact, you can. It's not, in fact, it's not that difficult. Yes, that's also a very good way of figuring out the Riemann surface, although visualizing it sometimes is not so clear. But I'll leave it as an exercise. I invite you to try. Very good. So everything I've said so far, are there any questions? So the conclusion so far is the following. Can I erase here? Yeah? OK. As I said, all of the things I'm saying are in the review, including the pictures. So the conclusion is that for a gauge theory that has only gluons, or perhaps also matter in the adjoint representation, because that matter also will have two indices. Okay, everything I've said depends only on having two indices, which means all the lines are double lines. For that theory, any amplitude can be written as a sum. Of course, as an expansion in Feynman diagrams, is a sum over genus of nc to the chi, where chi is the Euler character of the Riemann surface associated to the Feynman diagram, times, for each topology, you still have an expansion in loops. Okay, remember there were diagrams that were like nc squared, lambda, nc squared, lambda squared, et cetera. So a sum over powers of lambda. So some constants that depend on the genus and n times lambda to the n. Now, this is the reason why, in the large NC limit at least, a gauge theory has something to do with the string theory. Because this expansion, this first sum, is the sum over topologies of Riemann surfaces. OK? And each of them contributes with a power nc to the chi, or if you like, in terms of the string coupling constant, if you set gs, the string coupling constant, to 1 over nc, you know that the expansion in Riemann surfaces is an expansion in powers of the string coupling constant. Yes? It's the loop counting parameter. OK? So if you look at how much each of them contributes with what power of gs, you will see that it contributes with gs for vacuum diagrams to the minus chi. And because here I have an expansion where the parameter is nc, this suggests that I identify gs with 1 over nc. Because here I have a chi, and here I have a minus chi. Okay? So if I do this, then the first expansion is exactly an expansion in a theory with closed strings only, because these are Riemann surfaces with no boundaries. With coupling constant, that's precisely 1 over n. That's the meaning of n in the dual string theory. And we will see in ADS-CFT that this is exactly realized. And then this other expansion here, we will see that it has to do with the alpha prime expansion. In other words, an expansion not in loop effect, in quantum effects, but in the fact that the string is actually a finite size object. OK, those two things are not the same. OK, I think I'm a few minutes over time. So the only thing I would like to do to finish is to tell you what happens if you now include quarks. OK, objects in the fundamental representation, not in the adjoint. But I'm a few minutes over time. So if you want, I can finish tomorrow, or I can just finish it off now. It's completely up to you. But feel free. OK, if you want to go, feel free to tell me. OK, are you sure? OK, so I have another 2 hours, right? OK. No, let me just finish it quickly, because otherwise tomorrow I'll have to remind you about everything. So what I want to do now is very quickly examine how everything I said is modified or corrected when we include matter, okay, fields in our gauge theory that transform in the fundamental representation. So fields that have only one index, one color index, not two. For example, quarks. Okay? So to see what happens, consider two Feynman diagrams that are very similar and differ only by the replacement in one of them of a gluon by a quark. So in particular, consider these two. OK, this is a diagram with only gluons. So in double line notation, this is simply this thing. OK? And this scales how? Powers of Young-Mills? Very good. Six vertices. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So this goes like g to the 6. Times powers of nc. Let's see. 1 on the very outside and 1 on the very inside. That's 2. And then we have 1, 2, and 3. So 5. OK? Which is lambda cubed times nc squared. And now let's draw the same diagram, but let me replace this inner line. Instead of a gluon, I can put a quark here running in the loop, OK? Because quarks have bilinear couplings to the. There is no other class after this one, right? OK. OK, so. So let's do this. But now this non-wiggly line is a quark. Okay? So in double line notation, you see what you're going to get. I'm very tempted to just erase it here, but I'm not going to do it because that's supposed to be bad. So this looks like this here and here. And then it closes up here, down here, and here. So you see, the only thing that happens is that because gluons are double lines, I have a double line here. But when I replace it by a quark, I get a single line. OK? So now, who can tell me how this scales? Number of vertices? The same. Very good. But how many powers of nc? Four. Because replacing a gluon by a quark always eliminates one of the double lines in the gluon. So this now goes like lambda cube nc In fact, to be more precise, this internal line here, it's not exact. This is a quark. So a quark, in addition to color, which I already accounted for because I introduced a power of NC for this line, in fact, they also have flavor. Remember that quarks had an extra index that goes from 1 to NF. So to be more precise, this goes like lambda cube NC times NF, the number of different types of quarks that can run in the loop. Okay. And this I'm also emphasizing because we will see this in the string description. So now you see that diagrams, the second conclusion is that diagrams with quarks, or if you like, extra quark loops, give you a suppression of order NFNC. OK, because this diagram is suppressed with respect to this one by a power NF over NC, as you can see. Okay. So now, just to finish, let's see what happens to the Riemann surface when you remove that line. What happens is that you introduce a boundary, which we didn't have before. The way to see that is just to draw the Riemann surface for these two, and you'll see it. And then with that, we'll conclude. So for this one, given the experience with the previous one, it's very simple. So let me first draw a sphere. OK? Now, we have to give numbers. So let this be 1, 2, 3, 4. And the one outside is 5. Is it clear? These numbers are for the different faces that we're going to glue together. So again, the one on the outside, 5, I always draw as the lower hemisphere here. Okay. This is 5, and this is the boundary of 5. And then you see, as before, you get this. Almost as before. But now up here we have this. OK, so, oh, that's right. So here there's another one. To here. I hope this is clear. So let me like that. OK. So this one is 1, the one at the front. The side is 2. This is 3. And this is 4. This one up here, the polar casket, OK, that's 4. That's the one on the inside. If you look at this from the top, sorry, at this from the top, you get that. OK? And the outside is just compactified by adding the point at infinity. Is this clear? OK. So this is, again, a genus 2 surface. Sorry, genus 0 surface. And S2, G equals 0, chi equals 2. So you get NC squared. OK? As you expected, because this is a planar diagram. So all planar diagrams, vacuum planar diagrams, scale like NC squared. Now, what happens when we replace this by that? What's happening is that this internal line, oh, sorry, this I should have put here. I'm sorry. This is important now, and 5. You see, this internal line is not there. OK, this one here. Let me erase it here. OK, so in this one, this line is not present. And if that line is not there, the corresponding little face that had that as a boundary is not there. Because remember the rules. To each line, you associate a piece that has that line as a boundary. So what we are doing is removing this here. And therefore, we chopped off, we introduced a boundary. It's not a complete sphere now. it's a sphere with a piece chopped off. Okay, so this Riemann surface now has a boundary. So in the presence of boundaries, the Riemann surface, the Euler number is 2 minus 2g minus b, where b is the number of boundaries. This one has one boundary. So chi now is 2 minus 2 times 0 minus 1, which is 1. So we get nc to the 1, which is exactly what we had here. Okay? And the factor of an f, you just, that doesn't come from here. It just comes from the number of quarks in the theory, okay? Which in the string description will be the number of D brains. Okay, so let me conclude. And we can all go. In the case in which you have fundamental matter, the expansion that I wrote for any amplitude, remember I said that any amplitude could be written as a sum over genus, and now you have to sum over boundaries too. Okay? So it's again an expansion in Riemann surfaces. But in addition to summing over topologies, you have to sum over all possible boundaries. Namely, this actually looks. All the possible boundaries that you can introduce, which is, of course, an infinite number in each topology. But you still get nc to the chi, and you still get a sum over n, c now g, b, n, lambda to the n. And now note one very important thing. If you only have closed strings, that means that the Riemann surfaces you expand in, this is very important, so let me write it down. So gauge theory with only adjoint matter, for example, or if you like, without quarks, okay? This corresponds to the dual string theory, has only closed strings, because it has no boundaries. The Riemann surfaces have no boundaries. OK? Remember we saw this. And the expansion parameter here is gs squared, which is 1 over nc squared, not 1 over nc. 1 over nc squared, because in that case, chi is always an even number. You never get nc alone. OK? If you now add quarks, then the dual string theory has closed and open strings. Why does it have open strings? Because boundaries correspond to open strings. Is this not clear to somebody here? That the expansion in Riemann surfaces for a theory that has open strings includes boundaries? Okay, so let me just say why. If you have open strings, when an open string, a closed string propagating gives you a worksheet, which you have to imagine extending to infinity, that has no boundaries. It's a tube, if you like, in a tree level. Then you have loops and so on. So there are no boundaries. If you have open strings, an open string that propagates, clearly has a boundary, which is this thing here. The Riemann surface has a boundary, OK? The same is true when you include loops, which is what you're doing here. All right? So here we have closed and open strings. And this is very important, because when we want to describe QCD with a dual string theory, we will need closed and open strings. And the expansion parameter is 1 over nc, not 1 over nc squared. Because now you get powers, even and odd powers. Okay. So in a way, the expansion is better, because 1 over nc squared is smaller than 1 over nc for nc equals 3 for pure Young Mills than for pure Young Mills with quarks, which is QCD. And then the final comment is that from this, you see that the planar limit in the gauge theory, which is the limit nc going to infinity when you only keep the sphere diagrams, okay, the ones that scale like nc squared, for example, that limit corresponds, nc going to infinity corresponds to gs going to 0. So the planar limit in the gauge theory is the classical limit when you ignore all the loop corrections in the string theory. And this is also very important. This tells you that large N QCD is a classical theory. It's a very complicated classical theory, but it's a, at the end of the day, it's a string theory, but it's a classical string theory in the large N limit. And 1 over N corrections, you should think of as quantum corrections to the planar limit. Is this clear? OK, so we'll see more of this tomorrow. Sorry for.
Yeah, try not to do that tonight. I'll see you again tomorrow.